Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the beloved Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, and we are both in the Washington region, so we are hunkering down and battening down the hatches because we might get an inch of snow this afternoon. The entire region is in crisis mode. Jim, as a couple of northerners, we find this slightly entertaining and incredibly frustrating at the same time.
Greg, I see a snowflake out my window. Cancel the Three Martini Lunch. Sorry, listeners. We can't do it.
Oh, all right. We'll soldier on. We'll try it. Yeah. Oh, wait. It was Lent. Never mind.
All right. Good, bad, and crazy martinis, as always. Let's start with the good. And, Jim, it's no surprise to our listeners that we love Bobby Jindal. You profiled him just prior to his reelection in 2011. He's got a track record of great accomplishment. Gave a speech at the Republican winter meeting in Charlotte just last night, and he talked about the Republicans have the right principles. What they need to do is explain them to people in a much better way. He had a number of points, and here's a quick Bobby Jindal montage.
No, the Republican Party does not need to change our principles. But we might need to change just about everything else we are doing. We've got to stop looking backwards. We've got to boldly show what the future can look like with the free market policies that we believe in. We've got to compete for every single vote. 47% and the 53%, and by the way, any other combination that adds up to 100%. The first step in getting the voters to like us is to demonstrate that we like them. We've got to stop being the stupid party. And I'm serious, it's time for a new Republican Party that talks like adults. It's time for us to articulate our plans and our visions for America in real terms.
Jim, finally, after all the hand-wringing, somebody with an idea and somebody who's proven that it can be done the way he explained it. I love the fact that he stood up for the different pillars of conservatism, social, economic, and he didn't really touch on foreign policy, but I know he's strong there as well. And just explain, you need to present a stronger case to the American people and respect the people you're talking to. Loved it.
We've been waiting for somebody to come along and to give us a positive vision and to energize us. And so along comes a guy. And here's the thing. There are a lot of people who have kind of, you know, given variations of this kind of, hey, we need to reach out to everybody style message. But one of the things worth noting is that Jindal can actually point to a state that was an absolute disaster area post-Katrina. And not just the devastation of the hurricane, but just a flat-out dysfunctional state government from top to bottom. Economically devastated, poor in terms of job creation, high poverty rates, you know, just every kind of possible thing. And he is attacking every front simultaneously, from school reform to job training to tax reform to all kinds of areas. And he has gotten such solid results. The Democrats had no real official endorsed candidate against him in 2011 in a state that used to be, you know, the state of Huey Long, you know, top to bottom Democrat. It was a thoroughly Democratic state. So worth noting that he has the record to go with good rhetoric here. Perhaps the most interesting and you know, thought-provoking angle to this, it might be seen as a rebuke to Paul Ryan. I don't think he necessarily means it this directly. But look, we talk a lot about the debt, and those are, you know, perfectly legitimate areas of concern. But as I've pointed out a few times, is that, look, the public doesn't share that concern. And we can try to persuade the public to care about that, and they ought to care about that. But in the end, we're talking numbers to them. We're talking something abstract to them. We're talking about this in terms of, look, you know that really big high number that the news talks about every now and then? Well, it's getting even bigger and even higher, and we've got to stop that. And most people are like, eh, you know. Whereas when you talk about growth and jobs, you know what, in the much more concrete and tangible terms, how our policies can improve their lives. And they totally need, you know, the Republican Party definitely needs to do this. You need to have something to say to people. Here's how our policy will help you. And it cannot all be in this abstract calculations to people. As a big fan of Bob Jindal, I'm glad to hear the speech is getting rave reviews and he's being taken seriously. I think it's a little early to start for the 2016 talk. As he pointed out, he's got 3 more years as governor at least, so let's let him keep doing what he's doing in Louisiana. Having said that, what he's saying here is good advice that I hope every Republican takes at every level to, you know, look, make it tangible and real for people, because otherwise you just seem very out of touch with the problems in their life.
As good as that was, we've got Dianne Feinstein for Martini number two. And to no one's surprise, she came out with a very aggressive gun control bill on Thursday, far more aggressive than her 1994 assault weapons ban. Here's Senator Feinstein laying out the gory details of her assault on the Second Amendment.
We prohibit 158 specifically named military-style firearms. Our bill also prohibits other semi-automatic rifles, handguns, and shotguns that can accept a detachable magazine and have one military characteristic.
Well, that military characteristic is going to be used if they ever get this thing through to pretty much ban everything. Because, Jim, I think military weapons have triggers.
Very good way of putting that. Yeah, I was kind of struck when I looked at was a front handle is one of the things she considers to be a forward or second grip would be banned on those things. And in the end, you're basically saying we want people using one-handed guns but not two-handed guns. Which strikes me as not really – at this point now you're just like, you know, you might as well just say we don't want them to be black and scary, but if they have wood parts, they look less scary to us and more hunting-oriented, so we'll let those go. It really is kind of a nonsensical one. I actually am feeling not too bad about this. And one of the reasons is apparently Harry Reid has agreed that there's going to be open amendments to this legislation. And you're probably familiar with the legislative concept of a poison pill. At some point – someone, either a Republican who thinks this legislation is a bad idea or some Democrat who thinks this is a bad idea, and there are probably a good, you know, the Mark Pryors of the world, the Kay Hagans of North Carolina, Manchin. I mean, there are a whole bunch. Harry Reid himself is, you know, been on relatively warm and fuzzy terms with the NRA. At some point, somebody's going to put something into this bill that's going to make it unpalatable to either the Democrats are already supporting it or making it, you know, something that will ruin the possibility of getting the 51 votes that they don't need if they decide not to filibuster, the 60 votes that they choose to decide to filibuster. I mentioned in the Morning Jolt, Boehner's approach to this is, hey, we'll look at anything that comes out of the Senate, knowing that any legislation that gets, you know, 60 votes or gets the support of the red state Democrats isn't going to be all that draconian. You're just not going to get those red state Democrats up in 2014 to vote for a legislation that's going to really antagonize America's gun owners. And so the bottom line is you can't get Dianne Feinstein and Joe Manchin to have the same to like the same legislation. Their viewpoints are just too different. And so in the end, I think this is going down. And I actually think that a lot of Democrats would much rather have the issue to run on and to demonize the NRA and demonize those gun owners in places like California and, you know, those safe blue states. And the red state Democrats would much rather be able to go back to their home states and say, hey, I stopped Feinstein's legislation, than to actually get anything passed. And in a way, this may turn into a giant kabuki theater, a very predictable bit of performance in which everybody – nothing is designed to happen. And everyone gets to blame the other side, and everybody feels better about that than actually passing on legislation because they deep down realize the legislation would not actually change horrific gun massacres or change much of the facts on the ground.
Well, I certainly hope you're right about that. We know that the Obama administration is essentially restarting the presidential campaign office to go out there and make a very public case and a very strong public case for their vision on this issue. We'll see if that works. I think the numbers certainly for a filibuster in the Senate, and I would obviously hope that the Republican-led House will be able to block anything truly horrific here. So here's another clip from Feinstein yesterday. As we've discussed before, this is one that just really infuriates conservatives.
It will not affect hunting or sporting firearms. Instead, the bill protects hunters and sportsmen by protecting 2,200 specifically named weapons used for hunting or sporting purposes.
Jim, I think Judge Andrew Napolitano said it best. The Second Amendment is not about the right to shoot deer. It is about the right to shoot a tyrant. And I guess that they just don't understand that very well on the Democratic side.
Yeah, and there's nothing about hunting in the Second Amendment. To give you a good example of just how bizarre and needle-threading this legislation is, Greg, I'm looking here at the Washington Post, which kind of did a chart of the different types of, you know, of guns that would be banned under this legislation. So if you have a detachable magazine at some location outside of the pistol grip, and so I think most people can kind of picture that in their heads, semi-automatic pistols, these are banned. You cannot have a pistol that has this. And you can kind of picture the idea of a pistol where the bullets are the rounds are coming in, not in the handle. But it's okay for shotguns, and it's okay for semi-automatic rifles. Why would one be deemed more of a threat than the other? Why would one be deemed more bad than the other? It basically comes down to one gun looks scarier than the other. And that's what, you know, in the end, this legislation is kind of put together by people who don't use guns themselves, don't ever want to use guns themselves, the people who generally have personal security, and who basically look at this and say, well, I don't need a gun. Why do other people need a gun? And I, you know, I've been through this this kind of transition in my own view over the course of my life. Look, even if you are, live in circumstances in which you feel safe and you don't feel the need to own a gun, God bless you. I hope you never find yourself in the wrong set of circumstances. I'm glad you live a life in which you feel safe without a gun. But the Second Amendment is there for the guy who's working the midnight shift at 7-Eleven. It's for the woman who has to walk home through the dark in a you know, parking garage or something like that. It's for people who feel the need for protection from dangerous people, and police cannot be there all the time. Why are people like Dianne Feinstein, who are protected by the U.S. Capitol Police every day she goes to work, why are they telling these other people that we're going to restrict your right to defend yourself because I've decided that what you use is scary because of the actions of some maniac somewhere else? It's entirely illogical. It's all designed to make them feel good about doing something in the face of a really horrific tragedy. I think it's actually interesting to see how focused on stagecraft this debate has become, as opposed to actually looking at what, if anything, would actually reduce the chances of additional horrific gun violence.
Very well stated. And fortunately, here in Martini number 3, we have someone to answer your questions about why one weapon is less safe than the other. That person would be Vice President Joe Biden, who was on an internet chat room type thing yesterday, pushing the agenda, of course. And this guy asked him, so what happens when, say, I live in California and there's an earthquake and, then all chaos breaks loose, people are looting and so forth. Why can't I have a weapon to protect myself? And here's what Biden says.
Yeah, guess what? A shotgun will keep you a lot safer. A double barrel shotgun than the assault weapons in somebody's hands who doesn't know how to use it, even one who does know how to use it. It's harder to use an assault weapon that hits something than it is a shotgun, okay? So you want to keep people away in an earthquake, buy some shotgun shells.
So look, if you're a nut job out there and you're looking to kill a lot of people, don't waste your time with the assault weapon. They're much harder to aim. There's a nice, big, broad spray of buckshot from a shotgun, and thus you'll do more damage, okay? So look, every nut, every gun-toting nut job out there, listen to your vice president. He's been through this in his head many times before. All those, boring times in Senate hearings about how he would go out and shoot lots of people, it's always a shotgun. So, I'm hoping someday when shotguns get sold with a nice winking, smiling, thumbs-up Joe Biden logo on them saying, Joe Biden tested, Joe Biden approved. If you want to shoot people, this is what you use.
Jim, have a fabulous weekend. Try to survive the teeny tiny snowfall, and we'll talk to you on Monday.
Oh, my God, here it comes.
All right, see you, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Karumbas of Radio America. Please join us on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.